This is Colorado Edition from KUNC. On today's show, drones are routinely used in fire suppression and search and rescue efforts, but researchers see another benefit to the technology.
Right in that column of smoke coming up from a fire where you just can't get a manned aircraft because of the safety, obviously.
Using drones to fight the impacts of climate change and wildfires.
Plus, a conversation about how Colorado is educating workers for the jobs of the future.
And we explore another piece of the school safety puzzle.
That's coming up.
It's Tuesday, September 10th. You're listening to KUNC's Colorado Edition, your daily look at the news from around the state. I'm Henry Zimmerman.
And I'm Erin O'Toole. Two efforts to recall two Democratic state senators came to an end today. The group behind the attempt to recall Pete Lee of Colorado Springs and Brittany Pedersen of Lakewood says they will not be turning in petition signatures. The signature deadline was 5 o'clock today for Lee. The deadline for Pedersen was next week. That leaves one recall attempt outstanding, that for Senate President Leroy Garcia. The deadline to turn in petition signatures for that is October 18th.
Over the last few weeks, we've reported on a few different recall efforts around the state, from local officials like the mayor pro tem of Estes Park to statewide office holders like Governor Jared Polis. A recall effort against him failed to submit enough signatures by last week's deadline.
And there appears to be growing interest in reforming the way recalls work in Colorado. That's the subject of an article out today by Jesse Paul of the Colorado Sun. He joins us now to discuss. Jesse, welcome to Colorado Edition.
Thanks so much for having me.
How do other states handle recalls differently from Colorado?
Recalls are actually the exception, not the rule in the United States. There's actually only 19 states in the country that allow for recalls. And 8 of those states require some kind of reason for a recall to be initiated before backers of an effort to oust an elected official from office can move forward. And Colorado is not among those 8 states. So there's a bipartisan push now to align Colorado with those 8 states and make a few other changes to the process here to kind of bring it in line as more and more of these recalls spread across Colorado.
And just to require more of a reason, I guess.
Right. So other states have some kind of set reason that might have to be approved by a judge before someone can launch the recall. In Colorado, you don't need any reason at all. And that's why, you know, you see people kind of with a hodgepodge of reasons for trying to oust somebody from office.
What would it take to change the way Colorado handles recalls?
Recalls are a constitutional right of Colorado citizens. So in order to really whole cloth change the way recalls are done in Colorado, you'd likely have to make a constitutional amendment, which will require 2/3 support in both the House and Senate, and then the approval of 55% of voters in the state. Now, that's a really hard thing to get because, remember, this is a highly charged issue, and it would be hard to get Republicans, Democrats on the same page on that kind of level in the legislature, not to mention have voters approve something that would effectively be pitched as taking their power away. So that is going to be a very steep hill to climb.
Two state lawmakers, Jack Tate and Tom Sullivan, are leading the calls for reform in Colorado. Can you remind us who they are?
Jack Tate is a Republican from Centennial. Tom Sullivan is a Democrat from Centennial. They actually ran against each other for the state Senate seat that Jack Tate sits in now, back in 2016. And Tom Sullivan's son was killed in the 2012 Aurora Theater shooting. He just finished up his first year in the legislature and was targeted by a recall campaign over the summer, which was abandoned before it even got really going. And both of these guys, you know, basically say that the system, the recall system in Colorado, needs a second look. And they have independent ideas and are working separately right now toward bringing something or some things before the state legislature here in the 2020 legislative session next year.
It seems notable that they're on opposite sides of the aisle.
Absolutely. This issue has been something that riles up people on both sides of the aisle in Colorado. So to see a bipartisan coalition starting to build, calling for changes to the recall system, it is really important. It gives legitimacy to something that is so politically charged here. It's recall is almost like a dirty word in the Capitol. So having, you know, people on both sides of the aisle trying to fix it or trying to make it better is something worth paying attention to.
So let's talk about what change might look like. What are Tate and Sullivan calling for?
So Sullivan has a few things that he'd like to see happen. He wants to increase the difficulty to actually get a recall on the ballot by, instead of using a 25% threshold in terms of number of signatures required to force a special election, from the number of votes cast in that official's latest election to 25% of a district's registered voters. So that'd be a big jump. And then Tate is looking at a change that would mandate that only verifiably accurate information is on a recall petition that people would sign to try and force special recall election. And he also wants to ball recall elections during the 120-day legislative session to make sure the lawmakers aren't distracted from the work that they're supposed to be doing on behalf of the people. Jack Tate is looking at doing some kind of statutory change, which wouldn't require that voter approval and supermajority, which would appear to have a better chance of passage.
Do you get the sense that other state lawmakers support this move to change the way recalls work? Anything from like the leadership of the House?
Yeah, I mean, this is a perennial question, I think, for everybody in the legislature about whether or not these things are working the way they're supposed to. And certainly there's Democratic interest in getting some reforms done. Both the leadership in the Colorado House of Representatives and the Colorado Senate have expressed interest to me in doing something this session. They both also said that it would be incredibly difficult given the political dynamics involved. For instance, you know, House Speaker Casey Becker said she's not sure exactly what those changes would look like, but she thinks that the process could be smoother and better. And also House Majority Leader Alec Garnett basically said, however, that it's really difficult to try and think about these things while active recalls are underway.
Jesse Paul is a reporter for the Colorado Sun. You'll find a link to his reporting at our website, KUNC.org. Jesse, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And now a look at today's news. Reports to the state's tip line about issues like suicide, bullying, and drugs were up significantly this August compared with last August. Students, parents, and school staff reported more than 1,500 concerns through the state's Safe to Tell tip line this August. That's a 75% increase compared to last year. State data indicates it's part of a continuing trend. The Colorado Attorney General's office says this increase shows students are comfortable using Safe to Tell.
Officials say horses from seven states, including Colorado, have been banned from participating in an Ohio horse show. The decision was made to protect livestock from contracting vesicular stomatitis. Colorado has seen more than 150 cases in Weld, Larimer, and other counties. The disease primarily affects horses, but can also infect cattle, swine, sheep, and goats. The disease has not been found in Ohio.
There's a national conversation going on about whether arming teachers is a good idea or a bad one. In many states, including Colorado, it's up to the school districts to decide whether staff can carry concealed weapons and what training they'll have to go through. KUNC's Ray Ellen Bichelle followed along with a group at a weekend workshop in Colorado. And a warning for listeners, this story includes the sound of gunshots.
Instructor Graham Dunn is holding up some printouts with faces on them. He tells his students these are smaller than real heads.
So here's some useless knowledge from being a sniper. The average human head is 6 inches across by 10 inches high.
We're at a facility in Commerce City, Colorado. Usually the people training here are law enforcement. But today, they're teachers, principals, bus drivers, coaches, and school administrators. 13 of them.
So just to make it simple, pick one of the big heads to shoot. That's your target.
They're holding 9mm pistols, mostly Glocks. Dunn calls them the Toyota Corolla of guns. And they're about to use them to blast their targets. Dunn is going to shout out some scenarios.
All right, here we go. You know the drill. Put your hands up!
Put your hands up!
Don't move!
Don't move!
Okay, he's lifting up his shirt. He's pulling out a gun. 3 rounds, fire! There you go. Good.
Next, the imaginary aggressor will have a knife instead of a gun. He gets the same treatment.
Put your hands up!
Don't move!
Don't move!
He's got a knife in his hand. He's walking towards you. 3 rounds. Fire! Move, move, move.
The group running this training is called Faster Colorado. About 200 school staff have gone through the program, mostly coming from 34 school districts across the state.
Very good. Nice work, guys.
One teacher has a Band-Aid on her hand from slamming in fresh magazines.
3, 4, 5. I don't know why I brought 1,000.
Looking through her bag, she guesses she's used 700 rounds this weekend.
700? Is that, did I add right?
She doesn't want to be named because she says then a school shooter might target her. That's an opinion shared by a lot of people in this class. Most didn't want to talk to me at all.
I'm probably going to stick to not answering any questions.
But Carl Donaldson was okay with it.
I'm Carl. Nice to meet you.
The science teacher says it would take almost half an hour for the sheriff to arrive at his small town high school.
My own kids are there. And I'm not going to stand there and throw a book at someone who's trying to kill our kids. And that's just a fact of it. And most of these gunfights are over in 2 or 3 minutes. And we can't sit around and wait for the police to get there. And it's going to be done.
Donaldson says he went through a psych evaluation, got his concealed carry permit, and went through a few trainings, including a version of this one last year. This is level 2, a refresher course required by his school district. They're about to wrap up lunch and divide into two groups.
5 plus 2, 7.
Okay, look, ready? 7?
One group enters a room. In it, there's something called the Forced Option Simulator.
This is a simulation gun.
Instructor Paul Gregory explains how things will work.
The only thing that moves on this is the trigger.
It's a dark room with surround sound and a video projected onto the wall.
All right.
A trainee steps up. He's a school administrator. Gregory tells him what to expect.
You are in the hallway, and there's a school play practice going on. And as you're in the hallway, you hear some shots being fired from the auditorium.
Okay.
The projection turns the wall into a school hallway.
Dude, there's a kid there with a gun. What's going on?
Students are running past. One is clutching his arm. We round the corner into the auditorium. It seems empty, quiet. There's a body crumpled between the seats. The trainee is pacing, shifting his weight from foot to foot, shoulders tense. And then the shooter stands up. The trainee fires 4 times. The shooter goes down, and the auditorium fades back into a wall.
Okay.
The instructors review the shots.
Here's shot number 1. He surprised you. Shot 2, 3, 4.
Only 1 of the 4 rounds actually hit the shooter.
So 25% hit rate. Where do the other 3 shots go?
In that wall.
Yeah.
And what's behind the wall? The instructors have some bad news for the trainee.
It's the preschool.
Yeah. It's what?
It's the preschool.
It's the preschool?
Yes.
Okay.
And how many misses like this are acceptable, they say? The answer, of course, is none. For Guns in America and the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Ray Ellen Bichelle.
Guns in America and the Mountain West News Bureau are 2 reporting projects that KUNC is a part of. You can find more stories at our website, kunc.org. You're listening to Colorado Edition from KUNC. In 2016, the State Board of Education voted to put in place a new report on kindergarten assessment results. But some critics of the report say it doesn't contain enough information, especially when the report is being used to make big decisions, like where to allocate funding. Here to tell us more about the report and what's being done about it is Ann Shimke, senior reporter for Chalkbeat, Colorado. Ann, welcome to Colorado Edition.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit more about the history of this report.
It all goes back to a 2008 school reform law called Cap for K. The goal of that law was to align preschool through post-secondary education. And one of the things that law put in place was a brand new kindergarten ready assessment that all Colorado kindergartners would have to take early in the school year. It also required the state to put out a report on the data that came out of that assessment. But they left the details, lawmakers left those details to the State Board of Education. And so about 8 years later in 2016, the State Board had to adopt a system for collecting and reporting that data. It was at the height of a lot of student data privacy concerns, and they chose to use a very bare bones report without a lot of information about how those kindergartners did.
What kind of reactions are we seeing to the report now that it's been around for a couple of years?
Most people say it's not very useful. It doesn't, in terms of guiding how public and private dollars are spent on early childhood education, they say it just doesn't help them. And so there's a push, I think, coming kind of this year to get something better, to get something more detailed, and to get something that can actually help people guide decision-making and resources.
So how does a report like this play into legislation? I mean, could it affect where dollars are allocated?
Yes, ideally, I think yes. People want to make sure when they're spending money, getting little kids ready for school, and even once they're in kindergarten, they want to make sure those dollars are being used effectively. Right now, it's hard to tell from this particular report whether that's happening. So, and with Governor Polis considering a major expansion of state-funded preschool, it's becoming even more of an issue probably in the next year or two.
Some critics of the report view the decision by the board to use this just very slim report as a mistake. So is anyone taking action to change the report? Is anyone looking at just how to get this better readiness data?
Yes. So the Early Childhood Leadership Commission, which is a state advisory panel of early childhood experts and leaders, they're looking at the issue right now. It's likely that they'll come up with some kind of recommendation sometime this year. It's unclear right now what that would be. There's a couple different options for how this report could be changed. It could go back to the state board, and the state board could adopt a new format. It could be legislation, and lawmakers could make the decision themselves, or there's possibly other means as well. So it's unclear what that's going to look like.
And just out of curiosity, I don't know exactly what kind of data is included in the report. Would they make changes to the readiness assessment that they give, or would the changes be made only to the report itself?
So it's not the assessment that's really the issue here. It's what is reported out from the assessment. So there's six categories of kindergarten readiness, and these are things like math, literacy, social and emotional development, physical well-being. So for each category, we really don't know right now what percentage of Colorado students are meeting those readiness benchmarks. What the report does tell us is that 41% of Colorado kids meet all six, but that leaves 60% who are not meeting all six, but the report doesn't actually tell us which categories they're falling short in.
That seems important to know.
It is. And that's why a lot of people say the report's just not very useful, because if you have, you know, 18% of kids meeting four categories, you don't know where the problems are.
Ann Shimke is a senior reporter for Chalkbeat Colorado. Ann, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Last week, Governor Polis signed an executive order creating the Office of Future of Work at the Department of Labor and Employment, or CDLE. This office will be a central point for the state's effort to respond to Colorado's rapidly changing economy and workforce. Here to discuss this new office is KUNC's Stephanie Daniel. Hi, Stephanie.
Hello.
Okay, so tell us, what will this new office really do?
The Office of Future of Work, headed up by Director Catherine Keegan, will bring different education and economic stakeholders together. The goal is to figure out how to best serve the needs of Coloradans as the workforce changes and the skills required to do these jobs change as well. The office will be working with various state agencies, including the Departments of Education, Higher Education, Economic Development, and International Trade. I spoke to Joe Barella, the executive director of CDLE, and I asked him for an example of a changing workforce. He mentioned logistic jobs, like heavy machine operators.
So as we think about CDL licensure and people that want to go into logistics, how do we prepare them to maybe be more tech-enabled? And so as they work with self-driving vehicles, what are the skills and competencies or the jobs that will be created as that evolves, that industry or occupation evolves, and what are maybe the jobs that will not evolve and they'll have to think about upskilling or changing industries?
Stephanie, you've done extensive reporting on this topic, and last May produced an in-depth series called Hire Me, Educating Colorado's Changing Workforce. The state has a master plan for 66% of Colorado adults to have a post-secondary degree by 2025. Right now, it's about 57%. Your series examined the feasibility of that plan. How does the Office of the Future of Work factor into that and the disparity between the goal and what we've got right now?
The master plan you mentioned and the new office both address the same challenge. The workforce is changing, and jobs will demand skill sets that go beyond a high school education. More education will be needed. As part of my Hire Me series, I reported on a manufacturing company that has a hard time finding skilled mechanics. So, in partnership with a community college, it created an apprenticeship program for current employees. This type of employee investment is exactly what the future of work wants to encourage. Here's Barella again.
We need to change the paradigm and said there, you are never done learning, and that learning needs to be connected to your career potential or your career opportunities. And so we need to get in front of that and make sure that, you know, yes, we want our business and industries to invest in their workforce, but we also want workers and learners to know that the learning and the upskilling is something that is constant.
Barella said workforces have evolved in the past. We've moved from an agricultural to manufacturing and now an informational society. But this change is happening so fast, there's a sense of urgency to get out in front of it and be proactive.
Colorado has one of the most educated workforces in the country. So what does the state really need to do better in terms of changing demands for workers?
Colorado is one of the most educated states, but a lot of these workers have moved here for specific jobs. Barella told me as the cost of living increases, the number of well-educated transplants will slow down. Now, what I also learned through my reporting is Colorado also has one of the highest post-secondary attainment gaps in the country. Completion rates are twice as high for white residents compared to Hispanic. This is problematic because Hispanics are the largest and fastest growing ethnic group in the state. They also make up about one-third of residents under the age of 18. Barella said the state needs to invest in residents and promote all options, certificates, two-year and four-year programs.
What are we going to see next out of the office?
As I mentioned, the office is bringing together different stakeholders to create a comprehensive approach to help residents and businesses prepare for the changing jobs. The office also plans to launch a public campaign to make people aware of workforce development and training and job opportunities.
That's KUNC's Stephanie Daniel. Stephanie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
From more intense wildfires to prolonged droughts, climate change is impacting the ecology of the American West. And that's got researchers in the region looking at a new tool to fight some of these impacts, drones. Noah Glick has more for KUNC.
Adam Watts is a fire ecologist and professor at the Desert Research Institute in Nevada. We're looking at a video from a recent prescribed burn in Utah.
And now pretty much the whole screen is filled with alternating fire and black from the smoke, and it's really a hellish, otherworldly scene, and you just can't imagine being in something like this.
Watts was observing the fire with a team of researchers to learn more about how fire and smoke behave in large fires. They'll use that information to improve the models firefighters and land managers use to fight fires. But he says there's a limit to what they can learn at a prescribed burn.
We want some really big fires that are kind of like simulated wildfires. We don't want a little tiny prescribed burn, because if we study those prescribed burns, we don't get the kind of fire behavior and smoke movement that we see in wildfires. And that's what we're after the understanding of.
Researchers are a common sight at prescribed fires, but Watts's goal is to eventually get data from large wildfires. And he now has a tool for that. You see, the pictures and data collection from the video we were looking at earlier came from unmanned drones. That means he was able to get insights from locations he couldn't get to before.
Right over the flames, right in that column of smoke coming up from a fire where you just can't get a manned aircraft because of the safety, obviously.
And that's important because new perspectives can give scientists different information. For example, Watts is looking into whether microbes from soil can be transferred from one region to another by wildfire smoke. But to measure that, he needed to put scientific equipment right into the smoke. And that's a challenge because this equipment can be big. Some can take up the bed of a pickup truck. So to get it onto the drone, Watts and his team had to fit it all into something the size of a cigar box.
This emphasis on miniaturizing and specializing instruments and getting them in the air to observe natural phenomena applies to so many different things that relate to the atmosphere, water, and terrestrial ecosystems.
Drones are a new tool in a variety of ways, from fire suppression to land surveys to environmental information gathering, and for dealing with drought. Watts is also part of a team that has been testing drones for a process called cloud seeding. Theoretically, that can help mitigate drought impacts by flying aircraft up to the clouds and releasing silver iodide, which can help produce more precipitation. Science has yet to reach a consensus on whether or not the process actually works reliably, but climate change is making all sorts of ideas more palatable. Ira Sanchez Lugo is a climate scientist with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. She says increased temperatures from climate change bring a rise in extreme weather-related events.
You know, what we were expecting was to see more intense and frequent heat waves, more intense and frequent drought in some locations. The general rule of thumb is the wet areas will get wetter, the dry areas will get drier.
This is a business opportunity for drone producers. Mike Richards is the president and CEO of Drone America, a Nevada-based company. He says he started his business to help with search and rescue operations, but it's since evolved to include ways to help mitigate the impacts of climate change, like a longer and more intense wildfire season.
Some of the work we've done with power line surveys actually helps with that, because you're identifying faults which could arise in a spark and then a brush fire, which, as you can see, has turned into some pretty horrible results in the past.
As wildfires and other natural disasters overwhelm communities, Richards says drones can be used to more safely, quickly, and reliably get medical supplies and help to people in need. Imagine drones delivering first aid kits or life vests to people during Hurricane Katrina.
So what you would do is have them positioned strategically around known disaster areas, such as, you know, that area of Louisiana, for example, where the flooding and high storms or hurricanes, etc., can cause massive flooding.
Richard says Drone America was recently awarded a 5-year contract with the Department of Interior to gather and provide data on wildfires for agencies like the Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Noah Glick.
And that's our show for today. Tomorrow on Colorado Edition, we look at a legal challenge to Colorado's aid in dying law. I'm Aaron O'Toole.
And I'm Henry Zimmerman. Our show is produced by Lily Tyson. Brian Larson is our executive producer.
Thanks for listening. This is Colorado Edition from KUNC.